Today is February 8th, and Wednesday morning we're learning Probing the Heart and the Soul, Hasidic Insights into the Weekly Torah Portion. This week's Parsha is Parshat Yitro. We're going to begin today with a piece from, as it says at the top of the sheet, Rabbi Mordechai Yosef of Izbicher. His full name is Rabbi Mordechai Yosef Liner, from the Polish town of Izbich, and he's the founder of Izbicher Hasidut. The name of his book, as we've said many times, is the Mei HaShiloach, the Flowing Waters, where in Poland at the end of the 19th century, 1850s, 60s, 70s, these are probably sermons, drashot, divrei Torah, that he said to his Talmidim, his students, around the Shabbat table, either Friday night or Shabbat afternoon. They were said in Yiddish, and they're recorded here for us in Hebrew. And I have an English translation, as I've mentioned in the past. It's a terrible translation. So on the right-hand side of the page, I made some changes in the translation. Wherever I put a word within my circle in the text, on the right-hand side, I repeated the word, and then after an arrow, I put a better translation. The piece we're about to read on this week's Torah portion is my favorite piece in all of the works of the Mei HaShiloach, all the works of this Hasidic author. I think it's one of the most important things. I might have mentioned this in the past, and if I did, it doesn't matter. We could say it again and again and again. It's extremely important. It's also related in a certain sense to the previous class on Christianity, and also we will use it another 40 minutes as a jumping off point to learn the works of Rabbi Avraham Yitzhak HaKohen Kuk, Rabbi Abraham Isaac HaKohen Kuk. So, to know what's going on, we have to open up the Torah to the words that he is focusing on. Parshat Yitro, the beginning of the Ten Commandments, which is chapter 20 of the book of Exodus. In the English-only edition, it's page 115. And in the Hebrew edition, it's page
155.
God spoke all these words, saying, I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods beside me. You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image or any likeness of what is in the heavens above or in the earth below or in the waters under the earth, etc., etc., etc. That's the focus for today. And more specifically, our author is going to focus on verse 2. I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, the house of bondage. And more specifically, the focus is on the first word, the word I. And I'm going to put on the board the word I in Hebrew. It's that marker doesn't write. The normal word is ani. To write that in block letters, it looks like this. Ani means I. But there's another word for I in Hebrew, and that's the word anochi. I'm going to write the word anochi here. Anochi, or in block letters, it's like this. Anochi. And it means the same thing. Two different ways of saying the word I. No difference as far as meaning goes. In the Ten Commandments, when God says, I am Lord your God, it says Anochi. The second word, Anochi. Now, there is a linguistic difference between Ani and Anochi. Of course, they sound different, even though they have the same meaning. The difference in sound flows from one letter. Because if you notice, the word Ani has three letters. One, two, three. And the word Anochi has those same three letters with the addition of one more, with the Chaf. So, for the Mei Shiloach, the question is going to be, what's the meaning of that extra Chaf? So here's a Chaf, right? Or in black letters, a Chaf. Now the letter Chaf has a meaning in Hebrew as an independent word. Sometimes we just write a chaf, and it has meaning. A chaf that appears before a word, before a sentence, means approximately, about, kind of, like, almost. That's what chaf means. And it's used in that sense in modern Hebrew also. And therefore, the Mishnah is going to say, and I'm telling you now what he says before he says it, before we read it, so it'll be easier to understand. He says that the word Anochi means approximately I. Again, this is Chassidut. This isn't the simple meaning of the word. It's not linguistics. But from a spiritual point of view, he is reading into the verse an understanding that says that God said, when he revealed himself, it's approximately me. It's almost me. It's like me. Now let's read what the Meir Shiloach says. The word ani. We need a copy there? You have one, Mimi. You have. The word ani is not used for I, but rather anochi. Had it been written ani, the meaning would have been that the Holy One, blessed be He, had revealed His light to Israel in all its completeness. I'm going to stop there for a moment. This is the Ten Commandments. This is the revelation at Sinai. This is the greatest moment of divine revealment that you find in the whole Torah. God opens Himself up, as it were, to be experienced by the whole Jewish people. It's what we... it's revelation. And says the Meir Shiloach, that had God revealed Himself with the word ani, me, I, it's me, God says, it's me, here I am. Bask in my presence, hear my voice, experience my indwelling. If that had been the case, then God would have been revealing His light to Israel in all its completeness. And we say, as readers, wow, that's great, that's unbelievable, that's fantastic. Nothing better than God revealing Himself absolutely, completely, fully to the Jewish people. However, the next few words threw a monkey wrench into the whole thing, because he says, the end of the third line, and then they could not have searched deeply into His words, for He would have already revealed everything. In other words, there is actually a significant downside in full, complete divine revelation. Because if you know everything, you've experienced everything, there's nothing more to strive for. There's nothing more to hope for. There's nothing more to work for. There's nothing more to dream for. If you have all the truth and all the divinity and all the understanding and all the religious fulfillment, then there's no further work to do. There's no further journey to take. There's no further direction to go in. You might say, fine. That's good, there's no further journey to take. There's no further work to do. But no, not our author. Our author is assuming, as a fundamental premise of spiritual life, that the whole meaning of religion is in the search and the quest and the journey and the process. The yearning, the desire, the search for God is what it's all about. And if God had revealed Himself completely, there'd be no meaning to life. Isn't that paradoxical? It's the absolute you'd think, but if you think and contemplate deeply, it makes a lot of sense. What would life be without dreaming, without hoping, without striving? It would be so static. There would be no movement. And says the Meir Shiloach that movement and dynamism and progression and progress, they're of the essence of what it means to be a spiritual human being. No progress, no growth, no meaning. And paradoxically, someone who's already reached the goal can never strive for the goal. He's already there, and therefore his life is meaningless.
It's when you die.
Right. And therefore he says that God did us a great, great mercy by not revealing Himself at Sinai. That's why the letter Chaf is there. To say it, God is not saying I, God is saying it's almost I, it's almost me, it's kind of me, but it's not fully me. Let's read the next sentence. However, the additional letter Chaf in Anochi teaches that it is not in a state of completeness, yet rather a hint or a shadow of the light that the Holy One, blessed be He, would reveal in the future. There's great divine revelation waiting for us, but we don't have it. We only have a hint or a shadow. When God revealed Himself at Sinai, it was only a hint or a shadow. It was ki. It was almost. It was like. It was a preview. It was a trailer. But it wasn't the full thing. Thank God. Which means that according to the Me'ah Shiloach, the revelation at Sinai is not the be-all and the end-all. It's rather an invitation to a developing relationship. It's a beginning, it's not an end. It's a signpost pointing you in a certain direction and saying, move forward, search further, go one step more. But it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the end. It's not the full truth. And had it been the full truth, that would have been a tragedy. A tragedy. And then he says, the more a man apprehends in the depths of the Torah, the more he will then understand that until now he was in darkness. You're always supposed to be learning and growing and studying and striving. And whenever you do grow, you look back on yesterday and say, wow, I didn't understand anything yesterday. I was in darkness. And then you say, thank God, I learned more, now I'm in light. But since you know that yesterday is darkness compared to today's light, you also know that tomorrow when I learn more, I will realize that today was like darkness. Which means that I really know that every day I know very little, but tomorrow I'll know more. When I know more, that'll also be very little, but tomorrow I'll learn even more. And it's always a progression towards, it's always a journey, but I never get there. And were it to get there, there'd be no meaning to live another day. This is hinted at in the day and the night. In other words, the very structure of the physical universe, in which there's day and night and day, and they follow one after the other, that's a hint, it's a metaphor for a deep spiritual truth. And what's that spiritual truth? Day means that the blessed God opens the gates of wisdom for man, right? Day is a metaphor for enlightenment, for light, for understanding, for apprehension. And night means that man should not imagine that he has apprehended all in its completeness. For all he has attained is like night in comparison to the day that follows. So the fact that I live in the cycle of day and night, and night and day, reminds me that spiritually, every day I have is an advancement from yesterday's night, but it also is night compared to tomorrow's day.
Is it a Christian thing, or is it a non-denominational thing? You know, you hear when people die, and you know, or they think they're dying and they go towards the light, and is that God revealing Himself? I mean, is that anything we believe in at all, or anything that, you know, or is it just...
So I have heard and read in those books about near-death experiences, or people who come back from the dead, as it were, they do describe such visions of light. And we do also have in Jewish tradition, in Midrash and in Kabbalah, some of those descriptions of moving towards the light as you die.
That's God maybe revealing Himself as the light?
I haven't been there,
right,
but that could be.
Like your guidance, like is your guidance.
Yeah.
And also like a silver, like a cord, like a silver cord.
But that has nothing to do with the Me'ah Shiloach.
That's the ultimate. I mean, but to me, you know, that's where, you know, you say you learn more and you're enlightened every day. I guess it's just...
Well, here actually, we do come to something in what you just said that relates to this. There are some Christian denominations, perhaps more than some, that see death as a kind of release to the better life, to a better world, a better existence, a certain degree of even happiness and rejoicing in a funeral. So I've heard. Judaism certainly does not see it like that. Because if the whole meaning is in the journey, life is an end of the journey. And life is to be put on a pedestal. Life is holy, right? This is a truism. It sounds trite, but it's really true. Life is holy. And death puts an end to that journey of life. We have two lines left in the first paragraph. And I'm going to read the first five words of the line. So it goes on forever. The journey never ends. And it should not end. You should not hope that it's going to end. You should hope it would always continue, always learning and growing and understanding more. And it follows that all is night in the face of the light that the Holy One, blessed be He, will open in the future. There's always more light to be opened for us.
When does he come future present to this rabbi?
He doesn't say. It's a very good question. He doesn't say. And to me, it's just a metaphorical way of saying that there's always more light to be collected and understood.
That you never reach the future.
Right.
The future never comes today.
Right. Exactly. So just to summarize, this is a radical statement of the centrality of process in religious life, of growth and process and movement and discovery and uncovering. And it's also, of course, a philosophical statement that what's really important is growth, is dynamism, is movement, and not static. Perfection is not in the static, it's rather in the dynamic.
This is probably why scientists who are looking at or trying to discover what makes the universe, what make the component parts of the universe, say there will always be something for them to learn and to study and to find out and to inquire.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Because once you get to that end, I guess the end is deadening. I hate to say that.
Thank God there's no end in that sense. Let me just wanna, yes, I'll speak.
Rabbi, so what is the goal for this rabbi?
Very good question, right? What's the goal? And I'll answer with a truism. The journey is the goal.
That means nunca to arrive to God's place.
Say it again, please.
Never to arrive. Never to arrive. Never to reach God. That is not the goal. It's just having joy in the traveling.
Yes. Let me just say it the same thing differently, a little bit paradoxically, that you have reached the goal if you're always on the way to reaching the goal. If you stop being on the way to reaching the goal, then you failed and brought yourself further away from the goal. And let me just flesh that out further. Which means if you think that you've discovered the full truth and there's no more journeying to be done, at that moment you failed. Right? If you think you know all the truth and all the godliness and all the religion and all the morality and all the understanding and all the enlightenment, at that moment you failed. And therefore, it brings me to my second point, which is, this is a statement, among other things, about the religious value of humility. Because if you think you know all the truth, if you have all the truth in your back pocket, by definition, you failed. And it reminds us of the dangers and the tragedy of religious arrogance. Whether you're talking about individuals who think they have all the truth, or movements or denominations, or whatever it might be. Arrogance is religious death, according to this. That's a really, really powerful statement. And to me, it's one of the most important things that I think I've ever learned. And it's at the foundation of my understanding of religious pluralism and and tolerance. To think that my understanding or my teaching or my movement or my denomination or my synagogue has all the truth, that's religious suicide. Mm-hmm. Real suicide.
I think that sometimes I think about some of these preachers who get themselves into all this trouble. They probably think that they're everything, and it makes me realize why that happens. They think that, because
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and then suddenly they think that nothing's going to happen to them.
Right.
Is there a frame that this thinking has to go in that journey? Is there a steps and frame, you know, like a boundaries that if you go, you have this range to go in your journey, you know, wandering in your journey. But because already know now that the goal is not to reach God, number one. How do you travel in your journey?
Good question.
How do you go in your journey? Do you have a frame that you are in this range? You are in your journey. You are out of this frame. You lost it back. You need to. How do we know we are in the correct path in this journey? Now knowing that it's not even thinking that I can reach God because it's out of my earthly. Probably if I'm a Martian, I would have a better possibility. But I'm an earth person.
So look, Alma, if you would ask the author that question, the answer you get is pretty clear. He lives in Poland in 1850, 1860, 1870. The world is bounded, the religious world for him is bounded by Judaism, by the traditional understanding of the mitzvot. It's a matter of purifying your heart to come closer to God within the mitzvot. It's a matter of doing more mitzvot in a better fashion for him. That's clearly the answer. In other contexts and other places, people might have more expansive answers. But that would be his answer, right? I can't give you an absolute answer. I want Myra.
Okay, two questions. One is, you know, the religious value of humility, and yet we call ourselves the chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
Not very humble.
Wait, is chosen?
Chosen
to search, right? Chosen for responsibility, not okay. Chosen to be better.
No, but.
I should say it differently.
Favorite.
Not chosen because we are better, but chosen because we want to strive to always be better and better.
Okay.
Greater responsibility.
I like that. And then, but you say we don't have a goal, but we do have a goal. Don't we have a goal to bring the Messiah?
No, I didn't say we don't have a goal.
Oh.
I just said that we never reached the goal.
Okay, but isn't our goal to bring the Messiah? I mean, isn't that all of our goals? Is to live our lives?
Yes, but what does that mean? It just means to have more and more and more truth and more and more and more God and more and more understanding, more and more tikkun olam.
Right. So when that all happens, then he'll...
So that's a very good question that Myra just brought up. If we take this philosophy to its logical conclusion, we should never want the Messiah to come, because that'll be the end of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So let's leave that as an open question. It's a good question, right? Perhaps in some sense we have to envision a days of the Messiah that include within them a further journey, further striving. Next paragraph. To read the next paragraph, we have to go back to the Torah. And we go back to the Torah, to chapter 20, verse 4. And I'm going to put on the board what we're reading. We're reading here the Hebrew word hesed. It says in chapter 20, verse 2, "You shall not make for yourself a sculptured image."
Number 4.
Verse 4. And what that is in Hebrew is Lo taselecha pesel. Don't make for yourself a pesel. A pesel is a sculptured image. It's an idol. It's a figure. It's a statue. Okay? Now, like all Hebrew words just about, you can take from this root and make it into a verb. Pesel is a carved image. But there's also the verb, psol. Psol is a command, means carve. Right? I say to Bruce, carve, and he gets up and takes his hammer and his chisel and he starts carving in stone. And what he makes when he's finished, when he finishes fulfilling the command of psol, what he made is a pesel. Right? It's the same root. So now we have to know how the Torah uses this word as a noun and as a verb in the context of the giving of the Torah. So here in chapter 20, God says, don't make for yourself a pesel. Fine. Everyone knows that there were two revelations at Mount Sinai, the first tablets and the second. What happened? Here's the giving of the Ten Commandments. Afterwards, Moses goes up to the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. And as he's about to come down with the tablets in his hand, God takes note of the fact that at the bottom of the mountain, the people made the golden calf. And God gets angry, wants to repudiate his covenant with the people. Moses comes down and breaks the tablets. And then Moses brings the people to repent. He punishes those who did the evil. They repent, and Moses goes up to the mountain to prevail upon God to forgive his people. 40 days and 40 nights pass, God forgives, and then God says to Moses, come up to the mountain again, and I'll give you second tablets. But this time, it's not that God's going to give Moses the tablets with the writing on it. Rather, God says to Moses, make tablets for yourself and bring them up the mountain. Empty tablets, and we'll write together on the tablets up there. So Moses is told by God to make new tablets. And the phrase used, this is in chapter 34 of Exodus, when God says, carve new tablets, God says, so, carve. Carve new tablets. Okay? So what we just said is that word pesel or psol appears in two different contexts. One, it's what you're not supposed to do. Don't make a carved idol. That's the commandment right here in the Ten Commandments. On the other hand, later on in Exodus in chapter 34, the word is used vis-a-vis what Moses is supposed to do. Psol, carve two tablets. I'm going to carve the tablets on the board, right? Like in the movies. There's the tablets. And this is psol, meaning make for yourself two tablets, whereas in the Ten Commandments it says, don't make a pesel, don't make a carved image. Now, of course, there's no contradiction here. In the one case, it says, don't make an idol to worship. In the other case, it says, make tablets. Fine. But the author is going to point out, how could it be that in one place pesel is bad, in another place it's good? Again, there's not a real contradiction here, but for the Hasidic author, it's a way to make a contrast and to teach a deeper truth that he wants us to understand. You ready? So now we go back to the text. This is why the verse that follows immediately, after it says, I'm the Lord your God, it says, don't make a carved image. Do not make any carved image. On which it is said in the Holy Zohar, the book of Jewish mysticism, since it was written, carve for yourself two tablets, that's the Charlton Heston stuff over there, two tablets, therefore it says, do not make any carved image. In other words, without reading on yet, the Zohar is just pointing out this juxtaposition, two different usages of the root pesel, psol. Meaning, do not make another Torah. The Zohar learns from this juxtaposition, do not make another Torah. And I'll explain what the Zohar is saying. Moses was told by God, psol, carve tablets. And in our Torah portion, we're told, do not make a pesel, do not make a carving. And the mystical interpretation of do not make a carving, it's not do not make a statue to bow down to, it's rather once God said, make tablets, never make different tablets. And it's just a statement that once the Torah is given, don't make for yourself any other Torot. That's what the Zohar says. And that's pretty straightforward. I mean, it's a roundabout way of getting there. It's a kind of creative, literary way of getting there. But the basic idea in the end is simple. God gave a Torah. You shouldn't make your own Torah. You have enough. You have enough psol. So don't make a pesel. So pesel here means an imitation Torah. That's what the Zohar says. Our author that we're reading, Emir Shiloach, takes the idea of the Zohar and makes a little tweak in it to connect it to the whole subject he's been discussing in this passage. What was our subject again? The subject was always be on a journey. You don't have full truth. It's only partial truth that you have. Humility, that's the whole subject. How does he connect it? He's going to say that this juxtaposition of soul and pesel comes to teach you the following. Just listen to what I'm going to say. It means never turn the Torah I gave you into an idol. Mm-hmm. Torah that I gave you is psol, carve it. Don't make a pesel. For the author that we're reading, it means don't turn the tablets I gave you into a pesel. It's a statement about how to live by the Torah. Don't turn the Torah into an idol. In what sense you shouldn't turn the Torah into an idol? Let's read it. He says, the word pesel, carved image, means something with definite form and measurement, in a state of completeness with nothing lacking. I'll stop there for a second. And he's saying something fantastic. Don't relate to the Torah as an idol, as a statue, as something with definite form and measurement, meaning never think that the Torah that you understand is the full Torah, the complete Torah, the divine Torah. Don't turn it into a statue. Don't turn it into something fixed that doesn't change and doesn't grow. So this connects to everything we talked about for the past half an hour. The idea is understand that God's revelation to you was partial, not complete. And don't mistake the partial revelation for an idol, meaning don't think the partial revelation is the full, complete, definite truth. It's only a shadow of the truth. That's what he means. Don't turn the Torah into a statue, into a well-formed idol. Don't think that the limits of this page is the end of truth. That this page, that this Torah is all the truth. No, don't turn it into an idol. Understand that the Torah is fluid in the sense that tomorrow you will understand it better. And the next day you'll understand it better. And every day you'll understand it better and better and better. And if you turn your Torah into an idol, that means you think you have all the truth, and then you'll stop growing, and you'll stop moving and stop progressing, and that is spiritual death. Now, I just want to say a few more things. I know that Meyer wants to speak. What we have here is a mystical concept that makes a distinction between two Torahs. There is the perfect, absolute, unchanging divine Torah, but we never receive that Torah. Because when we receive the Torah, it's according to our human understanding. Our Torah, as we know it today, in our personal lives, in our study, in our synagogues, the way we grasp Torah is only a shadow of the true, ultimate, complete, unchanging Torah. Everything we have on earth about Torah, whether in our minds or our books, is a human effort to understand. And that's good, but it's not the full truth. Whether it's your interpretation or my interpretation or the rabbi's interpretation or the chief rabbi's interpretation, it's all a human effort to understand, and it's partial truth. If you take that partial truth and confuse it with the full truth, you've turned your Torah into an idol. Always understand that it's going to change tomorrow. And it should change because you have to study more. But it's not God's Torah that's changing. It's our perception of God's Torah that's changing, and it must change. And don't mistake your perception of God's Torah for the true Torah. And again, it's about humility. It's about the journey.
As you said this, there were two things that flashed into my mind. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Thou shalt not kill.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things seem to be intransigent.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess those are guideposts to allow us to grow.
It's all guideposts. Let me give you an example. You think those things are intransitive? Do not kill. Well, what does it mean to kill?
In
one generation, we might think that going to war and pulling a trigger and causing the death of someone is not forbidden by that commandment. Another generation, we might come to the conclusion it is forbidden by that commandment.
Right.
Or take abortion. Take so many different issues. It's not. It's always developing, and the Mishloach assumes it's always developing a little bit better, a little bit closer to the ultimate truth.
But if someone was standing here with a knife over my child, and I kill them to save my child's life, what it means, the meaning then can be, thou shalt not kill just to kill.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can kill in order to protect life.
Very good point that you brought up. I actually want to elaborate on that in the following sense. It's about humility. It's about the partiality of truth as we know it. But it's not about deluded loyalty to the truth as we know it. In other words, just because I know that tomorrow my knowledge may be better and more complete, that doesn't mean that I should have any less loyalty to the truth as I know it today. And this is a nuance that's so important. The Meshiloach does not mean to dilute your loyalty to what you believe in. You have to be totally committed and loyal to Judaism, even though you know that in your child's generation, Judaism might be understood by her and her rabbi a little bit differently. But that doesn't take away from the fact that today we have the best we have, the best that's possible. And God forbid that we should say, I know another 50 years the United States Supreme Court might interpret the Constitution differently, and therefore today I won't observe the laws of the U.S. No, the laws of the U.S. are the laws of the U.S. today. They're binding. They might change tomorrow, but that doesn't matter. Today it's the best we have. The same thing with the Torah. The way we understand it is the best we have, and you're bound to it. And you have to be loyal, you have to love it, and you have to be able to see the divinity in it, even though it's not full divinity. That is the meaning of living with partial truth. It doesn't mean less devotion. It just means less arrogance. And that's hard. But it's not impossible.
I have a question to you. The tablets that Moses broke when he saw the golden calf that he threw down, was that the full, complete?
Ten commandments. Just ten commandments. Yeah.
Okay.
Not the rest of it. Myra.
This is just a point of clarification. You were talking about, not receiving the whole Torah, whatever, but is it true that God didn't give Moses, the whole Torah, he left out the vows, or he left out the, so that it wasn't complete, and that it completed as it went along? I mean, is that just something I've heard?
It's certainly true that the written Hebrew text doesn't have vowels, and certain words could be pronounced differently than the way we normally pronounce them. And it's certainly true that rabbinic philosophies, the Torah was given with many, many elements that are unclear in order to give the Jewish people the opportunity to co-create the Torah with God, to add our interpretation every generation. And that's the same, the journey. In other words, the same thing you're saying. The same thing, that the revelation is incomplete. It's as if God revealed himself, kind of almost approximately, in order to allow us to journey, to put in our own understandings. But according to the Me'ar Shiloh, our own understandings are not creations from nothing. They're rather uncovering the latent levels of possibility and interpretation that the text has put there waiting for us to unlock, waiting for us to discover. And each generation discovers its own discoveries. I want to tell a story that perhaps I've told before in a different context. Rashi, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhaki, was known and is known as the greatest Jewish Bible commentator who ever lived. He wrote a commentary in the whole Tanakh from the beginning to the end. Rashi had a number of daughters and no sons, and his daughters got married and had a number of children. So Rashi has lots of grandsons. And one of the grandsons, his name was Shmuel, Samuel, Sam. And in Hebrew, his full name is Rabbi Shmuel ben Meir, Rashbam. That's the acronym for Shmuel ben Meir, Rashbam. The Rashbam himself, Rashi's grandson, wrote a commentary on the Torah. And the Rashbam writes in his commentary, he tells the following story, that once upon a time, I looked at my grandfather's commentary, and I wrote my own commentary, and in this particular verse in Genesis, I came to him, to Rashi, and I told him, Grandpa, look what I wrote, look what you wrote, my interpretation makes more sense than yours. And Rashi said to him, you're right, and had I had time, said Rashi, I would have written a new commentary. A new commentary that reflects the Pshatim HaMitchadshim B'chol Yom. A commentary that reflects the interpretations that reveal themselves in each generation. Every day is new interpretations. And that's the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be a matter of growth and new light. That doesn't mean that the old is bad or wrong, but the old is a building block for the new. Until the new comes, the old is all we have, and we should hold fast to it and be greatly loyal to it, but always searching to find the new level of interpretation. Let me give another example. In this very room, just a few weeks ago, we studied about the daughter of Paro. And I found it to be an exciting class, and I said at that point that I discovered things I never knew and never saw. And some of those things I never knew and never saw, they're not written in Rashi, not written in the Talmud. I quote-unquote discovered them. How could that be? I discovered things that Rashi never saw, that the rabbis of the Talmud never saw. Am I so great? God forbid. But every generation has new insights, and we're supposed to have new insights. And the Torah grows, and our understanding grows, and it should never stop growing. And of course, the fact that I know that tomorrow I might discover something new, well, that means I should be very humble with what I know today. Not less loyal to it, but humble about it. Not less devoted to it, but less arrogant about it.
It seems as if we are being told there is another commandment. Don't be a fundamentalist.
That's certainly part of it, Bruce.
Yeah.
That's the meta commandment that undergirds the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Right? Because when you know it's a process, you cannot be a fundamentalist. There are two contradictory concepts, I would say. But that's a very good point. That's a really good point. Yeah. So, I stopped in the middle of a sentence. So I'll go back and read the sentence and finish it up. The word pesel, carved image, means something with definite form and measurement. in a state of completeness, with nothing lacking. And this exists only in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, that might sound like we just contradicted everything we said. He says it exists in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. It sounds like he's saying in the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu there is completeness and there is perfection. What he means to say is what we explained 5 minutes ago, that it's as if to say there are two concepts of Torah. There's the divine Torah, the perfect Torah, the absolute unchanging Torah that God has in heaven, as it were, as a metaphor. And then there's our perception of Torah. There's the human Torah. When he says the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, he means the Torah of God that only Moshe Rabbeinu was understanding. Only he had the level of understanding. But all of us, we perceive Torah a little bit differently, a little bit less. And we're always on the journey to improving our understanding. That's the idea. So since time's a little bit late, and I want to get to Rav Kook, we're going to skip the next paragraph. And all we will do is pick up 7 lines from the end after footnote 36 on the same page. Bruce, on the same page. 7 lines from the end of the first page after the footnote 36. Therefore, the Torah includes all possible combinations. Do you see that?
Yes.
Bottom of page, the first page after footnote 36. Therefore, the Torah includes all the possible combinations of events that may occur, and its light surrounds all the possibilities and all the experience that may evolve, and it's not in the power of any man to do this. In other words, the Torah has within it latently 70 faces. All the possibilities, all the interpretations, there's so much newness that's waiting to be discovered, and we have to discover it. This is the explanation of the Holy Zohar on do not make any carved form. We're back to that. Do not make a carved form, meaning positive commandments, and image. Do not make a carved image, meaning the prohibitive commandments, the negative. In other words, never turn the commandments. We're repeating ourselves now. Never turn the commandments into a carved image. Because you know that tomorrow we'll have a deeper understanding of the commandments. Don't turn them into a changing, unfixed idol. Don't worship them as if they'll never change. You have to be committed to them, and you have to be loyal to them, you have to be in love with the commandments, but still have to have the humility of knowing that tomorrow you'll understand them a little bit differently. And that's fine. For nothing is revealed to man in its absolute fullness. Nothing we know is full truth. So I just want to say something explosive in a little parenthetical statement, which is there is a little area of affinity between what we saw in the previous class and this class. The Meir Shiloach is telling us to be careful of worshiping the Torah as we know it as an idol. The Torah is not God. God is unchanging, but the Torah as we know it is only our human interpretation. Have a little bit of humility. It's not the full truth. That has a little bit of a connection to what Jesus was saying. A little bit, not a lot. Jesus was saying, but what was Jesus saying? Right? He was saying that you're turning the Torah into an idol. Now, Jesus' reaction was throw it out. It's getting in the way. The Meir Shiloach doesn't say, God forbid, 100 times, God forbid, doesn't say throw it out. And he doesn't say have any less loyalty to it. But he does say, be careful of turning it into an idol that you worship it if it's the full and only and complete and unchanging truth. Because tomorrow you might understand a little bit differently and have that humility. So there is a little bit of affinity here. That might be important to point out.
Well, it looks like Jesus was the first reform, the first Hasidic.
You're coming back to Meir again.
the new thinker, the out of the box.
Okay, right. Jesus was a reformer, right? He came to shake up Judaism, that's for certain.
Yes.
He came to shake it up and show what he saw as its faults. That's for certain true. Right?
That tell him, get out of your comfort zone. Whatever you are thinking you are doing well, probably is not so well, according to what we are reading with this new rabbi.
Yeah.
Unbelievable rabbi. Where are those people? Where do they live, rabbi?
You just have to search. They're all here.
Oh, they are here too, in Dallas?
In Dallas.
They are here?
I don't know. Okay. So,
one guy.
We have a few minutes.
It's getting fashionable.
And I'd like to spend another hour on this, but we have 7 or 8 minutes. Let us go to the next page. To the back of the page. And we're going to read from the middle source, Rav Avram Yitzhak Kohen Kuk, The Pangs of Cleansing, in an essay, a book of essays he wrote called Orot. And by the way, there's an excellent English translation, and I brought from the English translation. I'll just show it to you. This is really recommended. This is an anthology of the works of Rav Kook in a series called The Classics of Western Civilization, The Classics of Western Spirituality, excuse me, translated by Ben Sion Boxer, a wonderful job of translating very difficult material. The translation is so good that it's much clearer in the English than in the original Hebrew.
Because the original Hebrew was not his original language?
No, it was. Oh, the original Hebrew is so flowery and so poetic and so beautiful and so mystical that many people feel they're lost. But the English translation is really possible to read. It takes effort, of course. So Rav Kook, I'm going to read here one of the many, many, many explosive and reforming passages, if you will, in Rav Kook's writings. And it's based on, I think, the Me'ah Shiloh which we just read. It's a continuation of the same ideas, applying them differently. Religion is corrupted by the decline of the higher Torah, through which one gains the recognition of the greatness of God, the higher perfection that is infinite and beyond assessment. I will explain. When he writes that expression, higher Torah, think back to the Me'ah Shiloach. Think back to what he was saying, that there's a divine Torah that, as it were, is with God, but we haven't yet accessed it. We've only accessed part of it, and we're always growing towards accessing more. And when Rav Kook talks about the decline of the higher Torah, he means that when people stop striving to bring their Torah more and more in conformance with the divine Torah, when we stop growing, when we think that we have all the truth in our back pocket, there's no more growing to do, that's the decline of the higher Torah. We're not letting the higher Torah influence our lives. We think what we have is that's good, that's all. Our interpretations, our way of learning, our way of understanding, that's good, that's all. That's the decline of the higher Torah. But it's only through the higher Torah that one gains the recognition of the greatness of God, the higher perfection that is infinite and beyond assessment. Thus our religion does not yield the noble fruit it ought to yield. It does not raise the souls from their lowly state, and the numbers of those who dishonor it and desecrate it increase. In other words, when our children look at us, if we are living complacent lives without growth, and we're not striving for something greater that's beyond us, then our children say, if the way you live, if that's the whole Torah, if that's the ideal, then I don't want it. If they don't see you striving for something greater than what you have now, then the youth just say, it's not worth it. It's not accomplishing anything. It doesn't raise us up to a higher level. And Rav Kook says this, not only on the individual level, but also on the collective level. It's not just that if our children don't see us as individuals striving for something greater, then they say, if that's all you have, I don't want it. But it's collectively. If the people don't see religious institutions striving for something beyond them, if the institutions act as if that's all of Judaism, then people say, if that's Judaism, I don't want it. Rather, individuals and institutions have to show that they know that they're not the whole truth, that there's more to be built and added, there's more to strive for, there's more divinity. It's not that the rabbi is God. There's far beyond the rabbi, there's far beyond the way the synagogue interprets truth. There's more. And it's only when the individuals and the institutions show their humility and that there's so much more divinity that they're striving for, that's when they inspire others. However, the Jewish religion is rooted in the infinite. That's God. And God's infinite Torah that there's always more to discover of, which transcends every particular content of religion. What a sentence. God transcends every particular content of religion. What does it mean, content of religion? It means that synagogue, and that synagogue, and that rabbi, and that book. One synagogue, or all the synagogues, all the institutions we have, they do not exhaust the meaning of Judaism. There's greater. And if we mistake Judaism as we live it today for the full truth, if we mistake our synagogues or institutions, our rabbis or teachers, for the full truth, as if there's nothing more to strive for, then we've lost it. So it's not only about individual humility, it's about institutional humility. Institutional humility. The Jewish religion is rooted in the infinite, which transcends every particular content of religion. And for this reason, the Jewish religion may truly be considered as the ideal religion, the religion of the future. I want to explain that sentence. So why is Judaism the ideal religion? Because it knows that its present expression is not the full truth. Just listen to that sentence, right? A religion that thinks what it is all there is to be, that's a defective religion. A religion that realizes that it itself is not the full truth, but there's more to be added, that is the ideal religion. In other words, what's the ideal religion? The religion that knows it has to grow further.
Always changing.
Always developing, right. Always finding out more about itself. And always coming closer and closer to the divine ideal that it has not yet perfected.
Is that unique to Judaism?
Say it again?
Is that unique to Judaism?
Rav Kook claims that it's unique to Judaism.
May I come here? So if we think about this, that means that a lot of the rituals that we do, that they have been doing for 1,000 years, probably it's time to change them.
He doesn't say it's time to change them, but we should know they may change. They may change. And it's not just ritual, it's ideals, and it's understanding, it's philosophy. Everything we know about God are only things we think we know about God. But there's so much more. And if we realize there's so much more, it means we see a religion of growth. If we see a religion of growth, that's the ideal religion. The minute we think we have it all, then we fossilize ourselves and keep ourselves far from the higher truth. So we'll just finish it off and then we'll end. The religion of the future, the I shall be what I shall be. That's how God describes himself, the burning bush. In the future, I will be what I will be. Indicating, according to Rav Kook, an ideal of being in the future, growing, becoming, which is immeasurably higher than the content of religion in the present. Right? The ideal truth of God is higher than the way we understand our institutions today. We have to know that there's a difference between Judaism as it's lived now and the ultimate divine connection to God. The ideal essence descends many levels to become the Jewish religion as a corporate religious establishment, rather than the ideal essence of religion. So just to put on the board, right, if I erase here, I'll just say that here is, as it were, God and the ideal essence of religion. Here it is. But it descends many levels until it gets to Judaism in 2012. What we have today, Judaism in 2012, is a reflection, it's a refraction, it's a partiality, it's a partial embodiment of the truth. And as long as we know that what we have today is only partial, we're always striving to go further to the ideal, then we're good. But the minute we stop striving and think that what we have is all there is, then we lost it. That's all.
Yeah. Another week to think deeper.
I don't understand that last sentence. I've been reading it and reading it and reading it. It seems terribly confusing.
The ideal essence?
The ideal essence descends
many levels to become
the Jewish religion. Okay.
Right. In other words,
I'm fine. But
yeah.
But when you take the next few words as a corporate religious establishment.
But the Jewish religion is today a corporate religious establishment. It's institutions, it's a fixed way of doing things, it's a way of life. It's not an ideal up here, it's become a way of life. Understand that that way of life has descended. It's not the ideal. It has descended from that ideal to become what it's become. Let me give you an example.
So is he saying that there's been backstepping?
No, no, no. There's just been physical application. I'll give you an example. The Dallas Independent School District is searching for a new superintendent.
Yeah.
And they want a superintendent that's going to have a vision of change. How do they call it? An agent of change. He's going to come in with a big plan, a master plan. And the first year he's there, he's going to make some changes. And he's going to have the schools as he begins changing them. So what's going to be when he comes in his first year? There's going to be his master plan up here for change. And then it's going to be the schools as they are. And he made a few changes those years, but the schools still do not conform to the ultimate plan he has. They've descended levels to an application. Never think that the way you see the schools is the way he ultimately wants them. It's a process.
Oh, okay.
That's all?
Yeah.
Okay. So.
Thank you for the question.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.